Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melbourne and broadcast through the Community Radio Network. It's always a pleasure to bring you through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and this is part one of a new four-part program featuring the life and times of 76-year-old David Flint. Although technically not a baby boomer, David, as you'll come to understand, not only spent a good part of his life working with boomers, he also played a significant part in the Melbourne music scene development from those boomer years of the mid-1960s onwards. As David shares stories about his mother and father, we begin to understand more about him. We follow him through his school years, and when television hit Australia in 1956, David developed a strong desire to be part of it. Initially, it seemed highly unlikely. We learn of the circumstances by which this became a reality. In fact, it saw him working on Channel 9 on programs such as the legendary In Melbourne Tonight. But as his story develops, we become aware of the impact he really had on the Melbourne music scene, as he shares stories of the establishment of Melbourne's first, best known and most loved discotheque, the Thumping Tum. Here I am, talking with David. David, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me into your home. And could I start by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
I'm a Melbourne boy, born and bred, and I've lived here all my life. I was born in Thornbury, next to Northcote, on the 23rd of February, 1942. So, while a lot of my life was with the baby boomers, I was, of course, born during the war, the Second World War. So, I'm a little older. Most baby boomers.
Yes, just on the cusp.
It's been an advantage in that I'm a little older, a few years. Mm. And I guess it gave me a little more life experience for when the baby boomers became a real force in our community, socially.
Well, I think we'll probably end up spending a lot of time talking about those baby boomer years, but going back to your early years, what would be your earliest memory then?
Very good question. I happen to have a few. I don't know why or how. I can't remember what happened yesterday. But, I remember where we lived. I went home from hospital, and I don't remember that actual event, but we lived in Emmeline Street in Northcote, and next to us, really, was a dairy that the horses used to come up to, and off they go and deliver the milk around. I used to, when I was a little bit older, I guess, come through. We were only there for till I was two or three at the most, and I used to climb on the wood pile on the back fence and look out over the paddock for my father to come home from work, and I remember that quite well. And I also remember hearing, I don't know, the news that a double-decker bus had had an accident in High Street, Northcote, and people was showered with flying glass. And I remember that clearly because flying glass, that really fascinated me.
Yes.
When I was very young.
Yes. What sort of man was your father?
I'm very much like my father. I look like him. I have the same build, which is slender, and I have a lot of energy. My father had all that. But he was also a plain man. And he came out from England, as did my mother, when he was very young with his mother, who was a tough woman. And he went to Geelong, and he lived there. And then he went back to England and came back looking for my mother, whom he met before he went back to England.
Right.
For just a couple of years, I think. 1936, I seem to remember there were photos of him going through Egypt and Suez Canal and things like that on a boat that would have taken 6 weeks, I guess, at that time. And so he wasn't a complicated man. He worked at the munitions factory in Maribyrnong during the war. And I guess that's where he came home, and I climbed the fence to wait for him to come home. So, yes.
What about Mum? What sort of woman was your mother?
Well, that's interesting. Also from England, from Dover. She was more creative, I guess, than Dad. She won Queen of the Beach in Geelong when she was, I guess, in her early 20s, late teens. She worked at a shop called Bright and Hitchcock's in Geelong, which was quite, was like a Meyer, a smaller version of Meyer. She also was on air on 3GL doing a beauty program, because that's what she did in Bright and Hitchcock's very early days of the cosmetic industry, and that was her job. And I remember when I was quite young, and maybe I was having a day off school because I was a little ill, and she'd give me her scripts that she used to go on air with, and I'd read through them, and of course that fascinated me, and as we'll probably talk about later, it was an industry I ended up in.
Yes, indeed. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I had one brother, 5 years younger than me, and a sister, 7 years younger than me. And they're still alive, they're still well. One lives in Palm Cove and one lives in Gisborne.
Were you close as young boys, or was that five years too much of a gap?
No, but like brothers, at times we'd have a little fight,
of course,
an argument. We shared a bedroom, in our teens, I guess. I was close to my sister too, but my life has been very different to their lives. They've taken more the straighter,
the traditional
lives, the traditional lives, and I was the one that. Well, as my mother used to say to me, "Don't make waves, David." when I would disagree with something that was happening in the world or close to us, "David, don't make waves," because she knew I'd go and say something. And that's sort of how my life's been, I guess.
Mm-hmm. School, was that a good experience for you?
I went to a state school after kindergarten because we shifted from Northcote to another place in Northcote called Bent Street, which later I thought quite strange or funny. And then we moved to Maidstone, which was virtually a suburb of Footscray. And I went to, as it was called then, Tottenham State School, which was later changed to West Footscray State School, I think. And I had the neatest writing in the class, and it was always, I was put in front of the class as being, everyone should have neat writing like this, and set out their pages like I used to with borders and so on. And I was never looked on as a sporting person until one day in grade six, I think it was, out in the yard, everyone was lining up and having races, and "Come on, David, you can do it. Get in there and give it a go." And I was very shy.
Mm-hmm.
And off we went, and I won. And from then on, they all looked on me as in quite a different way.
It's interesting how those things happen, don't they? It really changes the response other kids will give if they think you've got something like that in you. And if you don't, then you're really on the outer.
That's right.
Yes.
Well, that area, even then, had its elements of people who were quite rough.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people who moved in were average people and families, and it was a new estate at the time. But there were still some rough people, and it was fairly often I can remember being held by one kid while another belted me and things that. And I remember my mother saying, "You've got to stand up for yourself, David." And that was fantastic for me. And not that I became a fighter, but I learnt ways around the trouble.
Yes.
And it was something that really helped me right through life.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with David Flint. And David is recollecting his early childhood and the various things that had an effect on him as he grew up.
Television didn't come to Australia till the Olympic Games in 1956. I remember going to the Olympics, Melbourne Olympics, with the school. And then, and I would have been in, 11, 10 or something like that, I suppose. I left after year 11 at school. I went to Essendon Grammar opposite Windy Hill, the Essendon mm-hmm. football ground, and for secondary school. And they kept telling me I was very intelligent, but I wasn't putting it to good use. In other words, I was a terrible student, which is typical of a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they even made me a prefect because they thought that might encourage me. It didn't, really. So I left after year 11. And then, in answer to your previous question, I looked for a job. And what I wanted to do was work in television. So I went, when I finished school, I went to all the three television channels, which would have been 9, 7, and Channel 2. And I had a chat to them saying I'd like to work in television. And they didn't have any room. Television had only been going for 2 years at that stage. And I ended up getting a job, the trustees executives company in their share department. Paid all right, 9 guineas. And I was there for about 6 months. I didn't like it.
I wonder why. That was hardly television, was it? Not for creative.
Then I got, I guess, a phone call or a letter saying, would I like to come in and have a talk to them? There was a possibility of a job.
At?
Channel 9, which was, and I got a job. And I think I was very lucky because Channel 9 had more sophistication, I felt, and still do. And it was becoming successful. And my first job there was working in props. In fact, it was my only job there right through for 3 years. And I worked on the Graham Kennedy show in Melbourne Tonight.
Which is possibly the most iconic television show that Australia's ever produced.
Correct. And the thing was, in those days, no one had any experience.
No, it was learning on the spot, wasn't it?
Everyone was learning on the spot.
Yes.
And I learned so much. I learned timing from people like Kennedy, with comedy, and props, and the guy in charge, Jimmy Alexander, was an ex-theatre man, so I suddenly exposed to all that life. I became friendly with, you know, the ballet girls, and we were good mates, and some of the ballet guys too, and, you know, comedians, audio people in the industry, and I'm still friends with one of the prop guys, and we still play tennis every Tuesday.
That must have been a very exciting period in your life.
Very, very exciting. And, you know, I'd work, start at 5 o'clock and work through, and we'd pack up after the show, and then we'd go to the Treble Clef in Toorak Road, Toorak. It was sort of a hanging out place, and we'd have a coffee and whatever else, you know, something to eat. And then we'd go home. And that was a very exciting time.
Television was really new. The medium that wasn't so new was radio. Was that part of your early life before television?
No. It became part of my life a little later, which we'll probably get into, and I had reason to go into radio stations and to I'd get to go on air. And I had, when I left school, I had loosely several things I wanted to do. I wanted to appear on television. I wanted to be on radio, do a bit. I wanted to be responsible for producing a record, as they were then in those days, and a few other things along those lines.
Well, you were an avid listener to radio.
Yes, I used to listen to The Goons and quite a few English shows. I had a crystal set. Radio wasn't that advanced in those days. I had a crystal set that was my first radio, and I, you know, tickle the crystal with a little whatever it was,
cat's whisker.
And I'd do That's What I Used to Listen To in Bed.
Right.
And then eventually, I think, portable radios came out, not even transistors, but battery radios, and they were fairly large. I'd listen to the Hit Parade, which was really the only pop music played on a Sunday night, I think it was, on 3DB, I think they had the Hit Parade.
Because in the 50s, certainly in the 50s, Australian radio music was pretty bland, wasn't it?
It was very bland. Look, the whole world was bland. It was after the war.
Mm.
People still didn't have a lot of money. Mm. You had ration tickets for a part of that time, and so you couldn't go along and buy butter, for instance, unless you had a ticket. And you'd barter those with neighbours so that you could go and buy butter if you ran out of those particular little tickets.
Most baby boomers really started tuning into music late 50s and certainly into the 60s. But as you pointed out, being 4 years older, did you start listening to that music that was coming out in the mid-50s?
Well, Elvis, I remember when Elvis came along, I thought, wow, what's this? This was fantastic. Now, that would have been, when would that have been?
Well, it would have been 57.
That's right. And I started work at Channel 9 in 59, I think it was. And before that, yes, I'd listen to the radio. And we had a record player and stuff, but they'd be, you know, the very old 78s and things then. And the music in Australia in the early 60s and so on was more cover and pop music.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, it was sort of not what I liked. I've never been a massive, you know, music lover as such, not like a lot of the musicians I was
going to get to know. Yes, yes.
I liked anything I liked, and whatever I came across, I'd love. In fact, I've just been to see A Star Is Born, and it was fantastic. The music is more up to today's music, and the acting was superb, and I really loved it. So I'll love that. I love rock, I love blues and soul, because I was exposed to it.
Indeed.
From 1965.
Yeah.
So, yes, I listened to the radio because I was interested in it.
Listen to older voices, the magic of memories.
Now, for people who are listening who may not be aware, you are really so associated with what became one of the most iconic and most loved music venues in Melbourne. And at that stage, Melbourne was, or certainly, the music capital of Australia, and that was the Thumping Tum. How did a young man working in television, which he loved so much, suddenly find himself developing a music venue?
Well,
how did that happen?
It's another interesting little story. After looking for a job at Channel 9, I don't think I've looked for a job since. At Channel 9, Maya were doing a lot of commercials. They were live. And the guy that used to come along was out of the display department at Maya, and he, after I'd been at Channel 9 for about 3 years, he said, would I like to come and work at Maya in his department, which was special promotions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the display unit, if you like. So I did. I left Channel 9 and I went to Myer. Now, at that time in Myer, well, the special promotions department was just this guy who's a very gay guy and me in that department. And what we did, we'd concentrate on Mother's Day, Father's Day, all the big promotions in store and television, which was handed to me because, as they said, I had television experience. My goodness me. You know.
You had more than just about everybody else at that time, though.
I'd been in the prop department and, you know, I did. I had experience, but, gee, I didn't know that much. But it was fantastic for me because I'd go out with a guy called John Newman, who's the John Newman, Tickie and John's and so on. He was in advertising and we'd work together. I was responsible visually, and he was from the advertising department, so his job was to keep an eye on it from a production point of view, I guess. Mm. And we'd go out on the tram and he'd keep me in stitches. He was very funny and he'd tell me things, you know, he'd, like tram conductor being hit by a tram and there were pennies all over the road and things. And it just, you know, so I learned a lot again in a different area. Anyway, I'd also produce a couple of shows because we sponsored, Myra, that is, a beauty show. Here we go back to the beauty area again. But the beauty show with Judy Ann Ford, as it was then, who became Judy Ann Stewart. It was called Beauty Book, I think. And I'm going to say I'd produce it. I did. But all I'd really do is collect the cosmetic products from the girls in the cosmetic department and take them into the studio, design the set, I did, at Channel 9 it was, and I'd create the graphics because they weren't digital in those days, and I'd make these little things. I could pull the top out and it would expose the title and, you know, and little animated beauty queens, I suppose. So I did that, and Geraldine Dillon's Fun with Food, which was a food thing for Geraldine Dillon. And the same thing. I'd have to design the set with mirrors I'd put in above the desk so the cameras could take shots of the pots and pans by looking in the mirror. And so I learned sort of a lot there. I was designing a couple of sets and I'd go out every week and we'd do it live, I think, in those years. So while I was in Myer doing all this, there were also people like Ronnie Burns. He worked in display at Myer too, so he was there at the same time. And there was another guy called Ken Moat, and Ken worked in fixtures and fittings in the display department so that if the men's department needed racks and things, he and his boss would design them and make them fit, you know, from a measurement point of view and visually. And, you know, Ken and I became sort of friends, and he and his partner, a guy called Ron Eden, they wanted to start this thing called a discotheque. So I'd go with Ken at lunchtime, we'd look at buildings and so on. Eventually a building was found in Little Latrobe Street. And then it was an old hotel, small, a bit like the Cavern Club in Liverpool for size and atmosphere, I suppose. So I helped, we painted it and we did things. And there was another guy involved, a guy called Vin Fitzgerald, who put the money up. Wasn't a lot of money, I must say, $100 and something, I think. But anyway, we painted it between us all. And then they asked my wife, Jan, my wife at that stage, and if she'd sit on the door. So that was fine. So every night we'd tootle on in there and she'd sit on the door. And I found myself sort of running the place in many ways. Just organising it, you know, organising the bouncers and so on and so on. In fact, to such a point that at one stage there was a function for people going overseas, and they wanted to book out the Thumping Tongue for their going away party, and they got a license for it. Came the close to the function, and the license hadn't come. It was a different world then.
Oh, yes.
And they checked and said, yeah, go ahead, it's all right, it's been granted, and so on. So I had nothing to do with that. It was not mine. The people who were hiring for the night, and none of the places were licensed then.
No.
6 o'clock closing. And so going along, and everyone was having a great time, and there was alcohol. And all of a sudden, I found myself lined up against the wall outside of these couple of gentlemen.
In blue? Yes.
They weren't in blue.
They weren't. Plain clothes.
It was the liquor squad.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And I was grabbed because I was actually, you know, the visible person doing all this.
Tune in next week when David shares many previously untold stories involving the Thumping Tongue, the constant harassment by the Melbourne Council and the police, and despite all of that, how the Tongue thrived to become a legend in its own right. Next week, part two of David's story on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Community Radio Network.